1995, 4.921. September 30, 1996, 5.181. September 30, 1997, 5.369. September 30, 1998, 5.478. September 30, 1999, 5.605. September 30, 2000, 5.629. You might notice something interesting about that string of numbers. They constantly go up. So how exactly does the largest one-year debt reduction in the history of the United States mesh with the government's own data showing debt increases? The answer requires someone akin to a forensic accounting expert, but the simple version is that there are two kinds of government debt, and Slick Willie, like a bad magician, was trying to get you to only focus on one of them. There's a good reason why Slick Willie is a nickname for both Bill Clinton and famous bank robber Willie Sutton. We get into the details of these two kinds of debt a lot more later, so for now this is just a primer for understanding how presidents use this to their advantage. Our debt comes in two flavors: public debt, which we owe to bondholders and other investors, and intragovernmental debt, which is debt that the government owes to itself. Adding them together gives you our total national debt, which is the number you often see publicized by the media. Presidents like Clinton often choose to focus only on the public debt and conveniently ignore the intragovernmental side when making boisterous statements. Why is that convenient? Because the amount of intragovernmental debt goes up every single year. The total of Clinton's claimed surpluses over the 3 years of 1998 to 2000 was $431 billion. Yet the national debt rose by a total of $261.1 billion, leaving a difference of $692.1 billion to account for. Looking at Clinton's entire 8 years in office makes the numbers even more eye-opening. The White House OMB reports a total deficit of $320.4 billion over the 8 year period of 1993 to 2000. But they also report the national debt increasing by $1.6 trillion over that same period. Something smells fishy in D.C., and you can trace the odor directly to the Social Security Trust Fund. Ever since the 1983 Greenspan Commission, yearly Social Security surpluses are required to be added in with the other revenues, like income taxes, rather than put into that famous lockbox and held for future payouts. Since Social Security and Medicare tax rates increased steadily from 12.1% in 1978 to 15.3% in 1990, the trust funds experienced a major influx of revenue. The Social Security Trust Fund, for example, had a surplus of $7.5 billion in 1985. A decade later, the surplus was $60.4 billion, and just 5 years after that, it had more than doubled to $152 billion. The year of that $152 billion surplus? It was 2000. Conveniently, that's the same year as the historic Clinton surplus. Coincidence? Not by a long shot. What was happening was that Clinton was simply borrowing every dollar of trust fund surplus and counting it as new income to spend, as the Greenspan Commission had demanded, instead of debt. This income then offset the debt he was running up in all other areas and allowed him to make statements like this one from December 2000. In 1992, the federal budget deficit was $290 billion, the largest dollar deficit in American history. In January 1993, the Congressional Budget Office projected that the deficit would grow to $455 billion by 2000. The Office of Management and Budget is now projecting a $211 billion surplus for 2000, the third consecutive surplus and the largest surplus ever, even after adjusting for inflation. Hans F. Senholz, an economist who studied under the legendary free market libertarian Ludwig von Mises, explained the government's accounting gimmick like this. Imagine a corporation suffering losses and being deep in debt. In order to boost its stock price and the bonuses of its officers, the corporation quietly borrows funds in the bond market and uses them not only to cover its losses, but also to retire some corporate stock and thereby bid up its price. And imagine the management boasting of profits and surpluses. But that's what the Clinton administration has been doing with alacrity and brazenness. It suffers sizable budget deficits, increasing the national debt by hundreds of billions of dollars, but uses trust funds to meet expenditures, and then boasts of surpluses, which excites the spending predilection of politicians in both parties. Here's another way to look at this. Last year you made $30,000 at your job and spent $32,000 on living expenses. Your brother, seeing that you were having a hard time, loaned you $10,000 and you gave him an IOU in return. Common sense says that your deficit for the year was $2,000 and your personal debt increased by $10,000. In short, it wasn't a banner year. But our presidents would claim that you didn't have a deficit at all. You had a surplus of $8,000. Congratulations! But what about the $10,000 you borrowed, you might be wondering? Don't worry about it, politicians would say. It's not real. He's your brother, after all. The dividends. Budget gimmicks aside, the truth is that Clinton deserves at least some credit for making real, tangible progress. Research by Brian Riedel of the Heritage Foundation shows that between 1990 and 2000, three major sources of savings account for nearly all of Clinton's success. Defense spending fell by 2.2% of GDP. Tax revenues rose by 2.6% of GDP. And net interest cost on the national debt dipped by 1% of GDP. The peace dividend. Think of Reagan's 1980s defense buildup as an investment that finally paid off when the Soviet Union collapsed. With the exception of brush fires in Somalia, Haiti, and the Balkans, there were no large wars for Clinton to fight or prepare for. As a result, the United States found itself without a major enemy, a luxury it hadn't enjoyed since the 1930s. Predictably, defense spending decreased substantially. Between 1990 and 2000, spending fell from $491 billion to $376 billion, adjusted for inflation in 2009 dollars. As a percentage of GDP, it fell from 5.2% to 3%. Even the subsequent war on terrorism brought the defense budget back up to only 4.9% of GDP. Take that peace dividend away and the results would have been dramatically different. If America had spent 5.2% of GDP on the military in 2000, the surplus would have been reduced by over $200 billion, and the deficit, accounting gimmicks or not, would have been undeniable. The tax and tech dividend. The tax revenue surge is often attributed to the tax increases signed by President George H.W. Bush in 1990 and President Clinton in 1993. But the proof that that's not the case is in the pudding, or in this case, the data. Between 1990 and 1995, tax revenues did not grow significantly faster than they did during the Reagan years, when rates were lower. Then, in 1995, the Republican Congress put an end to the Clinton spending spree, and in 1997, capital gains tax rates were cut. The combination of all these factors resulted in a soaring stock market and economy. New business investment fueled the tech boom, resulting in revolutionary companies like Google, eBay, and Amazon being born. Between 1994 and 2000, speculation over the potential of this new breed of internet companies drove the NASDAQ index up by more than 450%. The booming economy and stock market induced a staggering 37% inflation-adjusted tax revenue surge between 1995 and 2000. More revenue growth than had occurred in the previous decade combined. By 2000, tax revenues had reached a new peacetime record of 20.6% of GDP. As we now know, the good times didn't last forever. In 2000, the bubble burst, ushering in a serious recession that set back revenue and resulted in a costly government response. This was all just in time for the long-run effects to be declared George W. Bush's fault. The interest dividend. This one is simple but important. Rising tax revenues and falling defense spending meant smaller deficits. Combined with lower interest rates, this reduced net interest spending from 3.2% of GDP to 2.2%, a huge savings that Clinton really had very little control over. In fact, it could be argued that prior to his inauguration, Clinton didn't even really understand the importance of interest rates to his agenda. At one meeting in early 1992, Clinton was learning about the economic benefits and risks of focusing on deficit reduction. After hearing that one major risk would be slower economic growth, he received some good news. Slow growth could be offset by lower interest rates. Economist Alan Blinder, who was presenting at the time, informed Clinton that the only issue might be the bond markets. If they didn't believe that Clinton was serious about deficit reduction, they may not react the way the White House would want. Clinton was incredulous. According to Bob Woodward's telling of the story, his face turned red with anger and disbelief. "You mean to tell me that the success of the program and my re-election hinges on the Federal Reserve and a bunch of f***ing bond traders?" Nods from the end of the table. Not a dissent. It was an important lesson for Clinton and one that future presidents would often forget. Ignore investors at your own peril. They are the ones who can ultimately determine your success or failure. Gridlock is good. President Clinton and the Republican Congress's biggest accomplishment may have been that they simply got out of the way. Government gridlock prevented either party from enacting expensive new programs, which in turn kept other federal spending relatively constant as a percentage of the GDP. Sometimes a do-nothing Congress and White House is the best thing for an economy and a budget. In fairness, some positive reforms were enacted. In addition to the capital gains cuts just mentioned, the President and Congress were able to agree on the 1996 welfare reforms that ended the AFDC entitlement, as well as the 1995 elimination of most farm programs, which President George W. Bush would later reinstate. There could have been even more progress. In late 1997, President Clinton and House Speaker Newt Gingrich secretly created a bipartisan plan to permanently rein in Social Security and Medicare. It would provide Social Security personal accounts and convert Medicare into a market-based premium support program. The idea was for Clinton to offer the plan during his January 1998 State of the Union address, with Gingrich endorsing it immediately after. So why are Social Security and Medicare both currently still economic disasters? Because 6 days before Clinton's speech, something happened that would divert America's attention from the budget and everything else for a long time to come. The Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. Republicans and Democrats dismissed talk of any bipartisan compromises and instead armed themselves for political war. As a result, the most promising budget reform in American history died before it could even be unveiled. After that, none of the leaders from that era seriously tackled our budget's underlying structural problems. Like so many before them, they simply kicked the ball down the road. Unfortunately, America's next two presidents, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, were all too happy to pick that ball up and run with it. Right off a cliff. Congress needs to join with me to bring real spending discipline to the federal budget. Spending discipline requires difficult choices. Every government program was created with good intentions, but not all are matching good intentions with good results. George W. Bush, 2005. Chapter 9. W and O. The Progressive Era Returns. George W. Bush. Wars on everything except debt. There are two ironclad rules of government. Rule number one, they always try to expand. Rule number two, see rule number one. This eternal truth can manifest itself in a number of different ways. There's the slow and steady, ocean tide-like expansion that occurs over time. There's also the more aggressive expansion that comes by capturing a mood change among the public or cashing in political capital. And then there's the expansion that happens quickly and sometimes brutally as the result of an emergency or crisis. Most right-leaning administrations generally try to use one of those tactics to their advantage. The most insidious progressive administrations may even try to harness two of them to push their agenda. The Bush administration exploited all three. The numbers are not pretty, and if you consider that they were put up by a man who calls himself a Republican, they're downright embarrassing. Here's the summary, with everything adjusted for inflation to 2009 dollars. Total Bush deficits, $3.3 trillion. Total increase in national debt, Bush's real deficits, $5 trillion. Total Bush spending, $20.5 trillion. Total inflation-adjusted increase of federal budget, Bill Clinton, 12%. George W. Bush, 42%. Considering that President Bush was the biggest spender since LBJ, no conservative who truly believes in small government can defend Bush's spending record. Sure, you can blame Congress, and it absolutely is a fair target. But remember, from 2001 through 2006, the Republicans controlled the presidency, the Senate, except in 2001 and 2002, and the House. With limited compromise, they could have done as they pleased. Cut waste and bureaucracy? Yep. Force big discretionary spending cuts? Sure. Demand real entitlement reform? Why not? This was the time for a conservative New Deal. Instead, we got a conservative progressive era. The autopsy. Bush's economic plan seemed to be pretty simple. Tax cuts, and then absolutely nothing. It was as though Republicans forgot how to be Republicans once they were in power. Only now, as the political ramifications of their behavior have become obvious, are some finally changing their tune. I hope voters don't let them off that easy. In fiscal year 2001, the federal government spent an inflation-adjusted $21,500 per household. By the end of Bush's reign, 8 years later, that number had jumped to nearly $26,000. How did it happen? Four primary factors contributed to the perfect storm. The tax cuts. It's the same old story. Cutting tax rates increases incentives to work, save, and invest. Productivity and economic growth increase. Bush's two major tax cuts took place in 2001 and 2003 and were the largest since 1981. In terms of generating economic activity, the evidence of their success, especially the 2003 cuts, is rock solid. In the 6 quarters prior to the May 2003 tax cuts, non-residential investment declined every quarter. The S&P 500 fell 18%. 1 million net jobs were lost, and the economy grew at an annual rate of just 1.7%. In the 6 quarters following the tax cuts, investment rose every quarter. The S&P 500 leaped 32%. 2.3 million net jobs were created, and the economic growth rate doubled to 4.1%. The problem wasn't with the cuts, it was with what happened after. Politicians patted themselves on the back, used their achievement in political campaigns, and then spent more, forgetting to follow through on the other half of the small government equation, spending cuts. Ironically, it was that lack of discipline that ensured no further tax cuts could possibly be passed. Thanks, Republicans. The tech and housing dividends end. Many people forget that Clinton presided over years of a tech boom, and many others don't acknowledge that Bush paid the price for its end. But it was a very real event for the economy. About $5.6 trillion of wealth evaporated as the stock indexes collapsed. The NASDAQ alone fell from more than 5,000 in 1999 to less than 2,000 by 2002, destroying the value of the 401ks, pension funds, and mutual funds that people had come to rely on. The ensuing recession reduced revenue growth from an average of 8.7% a year from 1998 through 2000 to an average of minus 4.1% a year from 2000 through 2003. With 1.5 million fewer people working and less tax revenue coming in from individuals and businesses, not to mention a collapsed stock market reducing capital gains and dividend revenues, annual tax revenues fell by $250 billion between 2000 and 2003. Then, toward the end of Bush's terms, the economy endured the subprime crisis, housing market collapse, and Great Recession, which caused another $10 trillion of wealth to be lost. In other words, Between national security and economic crises, Bush was not exactly able to govern over 8 years of peace and prosperity, as Clinton was. The War on Terror. The Congressional Research Service has estimated that the total cost of the War on Terror to date, including spending on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is over $1 trillion. That sounds gigantic, and it is, but you have to put it into perspective. While some like to claim that the wars were the reason Bush spent so much, the numbers don't back that up. If 9/11 and the ensuing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan had never happened, President Bush still would have spent $5 trillion more, or $2 trillion more in 2009 dollars, than Clinton spent over the course of his presidency. Defense spending only accounted for just over one-third of all new spending under President Bush. In other words, the Republicans were going to spend big one way or another. The War on Terror just provided them with good cover. Spending like a drunken FDR. There's one fundamental concept that most politicians have yet to master: sacrifice. If you know you're going to a great steak restaurant for dinner, maybe you have a salad for lunch to even things out. The War on Terror was a national priority. Fine, you're not going to hear an argument from me, but then why not sacrifice in other areas to pay for it? President Obama has the same mentality. Extending unemployment benefits was a huge priority for him. Fine, but then Obama should have cut spending elsewhere to pay for the extra $34 billion. Instead, they just call it an emergency and lump it right onto our national debt, all the while talking about how we have to get serious about deficit reduction. The 8 years under Bush illustrate how little willpower politicians have to control their spending. We were fighting two major wars, and yet we still increased discretionary spending and passed new entitlement programs, even as the existing ones were spiraling out of control. Bush's first budget, which projected out the next 10 years, would have increased federal spending at an average of 3.7% a year. That's higher than Clinton's actual average of 3.5% a year, but at least it was within a somewhat reasonable range. Of course, that's not actually what happened. The Clinton years had left government appropriators feeling richer than they had in years. But with a new sheriff coming into office and a new crisis to distract the country, the restraints could finally come off. And once they did, all hell broke loose. The decline and fall of the GOP. In a matter of just over a decade, the Republican Party successfully transformed itself into the same corrupt, spineless, big-spending liberals it threw out of Congress in 1994. The 1995-96 government shutdown was a public relations disaster for a Republican Party that could not match President Clinton's rhetoric. Senator Bob Dole, Republican, Kansas, finally caved in and agreed to Clinton's spending demands in order to reopen the government, even as President Clinton was himself on the verge of giving in. It was a fiasco for Republicans and resulted in them deciding that even minimal spending restraint constituted political suicide. The Republican Revolution died in 1996. Fast forward to December 1998. President Clinton had been reelected. The GOP Congress had lost seats in two consecutive elections, despite the Lewinsky scandal. And House Speaker Newt Gingrich, Republican Georgia, had just resigned. Most important, the budget deficit that had originally motivated the Republican Revolution was no longer a major national issue. This was the political environment in which George W. Bush began his 2000 presidential campaign. By calling himself a compassionate conservative, Bush contrasted himself against the mean-spirited Republican Congress still reeling from the government shutdown. The budget surpluses had robbed the GOP of its case for spending restraint. Apparently, smaller government for its own sake was not on the table. So Bush immediately began promising endless new spending initiatives. The new GOP approach would be to use government spending to buy voter popularity. In other words, they would out-Democrat the Democrats. Here is how that strategy played out annually. 2001. Even after the 9/11 attacks induced a major defense commitment, President Bush sought to buy off soccer moms with no child left behind, the largest expansion of federal education spending ever. 2002. farmers were bought off with an 80% increase in farm subsidies, reversing the 1996 Freedom to Farm reforms that had phased out subsidies. 2003. Seniors were bought off with a Medicare drug entitlement, the most expensive new program since LBJ. 2004. State and local government officials were bought off with the most expensive highway bill in American history. 2005. No one is quite sure who the target voters were for the president's expensive Mars initiative. 2006. Pork project spending, ridiculously considered vital to re-election by lawmakers, reached a record $29 billion, nearly quadruple the 1994 level. Each large spending bill was intended to buy off another interest group, build Bush's popularity, and expand the Republican majority. How did this strategy work out for them? Well, let's see. On election night 2006, voters responded with a historic slaughtering, throwing out the GOP congressional majority due to their reputation as corrupt big spenders. Losses were particularly high among members of the appropriations committees. President Bush's approval rating, nearly 90% after 9/11, nearly reached the depths of President Nixon's before the latter's 1974 resignation. The clear lesson is that you can't out-Democrat the Democrats. This should have become glaringly obvious back in 2001 when President Bush signed legislation doubling the K-12 education budget, and the Democrats attacked him as cheap for not tripling the budget. Whatever reputation for fiscal responsibility the GOP had slowly built up over the past few decades had now been completely destroyed. They sold out their principles for power and ended up with neither. In 8 years, President Bush really championed only two significant conservative initiatives: the tax cuts, now threatened by his own runaway spending, and Social Security reform, which never received a vote. Bush's domestic policy record is far more liberal than that of President Clinton and maybe even President Carter. In fact, it is doubtful that an Al Gore presidency could have accomplished as many liberal objectives as President Bush did. Sorry, but sometimes the truth hurts. Not that the GOP Congress was any better. After completely giving up on the cause of small government, they focused on protecting their power through spending, pork, and perks. For example, in 2005, House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Republican, Texas, declared that there was no more wasteful spending left to cut, even though not one program costing more than $1 billion annually had been eliminated since 1996. Later, the GOP Congress refused to create even a non-binding government waste commission. DeLay's K Street project focused the GOP majority on this famous street of lobbyists rather than on Main Street. DeLay demanded that lobbying firms hire more Republicans and donate more to the GOP. In return, Republicans provided these interest groups with tens of thousands of earmarks and basically outsourced the writing of the bloated highway, energy, and farm bills to them. Former GOP representatives Duke Cunningham, Republican California, and Bob Ney, Republican Ohio, were sent to prison for accepting bribes and gifts in return for helping friends win government favors. Senator Mel Martinez's, Republican Florida, job postings required applicants to write a sample constituent letter defending sugar subsidies. The GOP majority refused to even bring President Bush's Social Security reform proposal to a vote. Before recess periods, House Republican leadership would distribute talking point packets to their colleagues, urging them to take more credit for expanding government. In December 2006, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, Republican, Tennessee, sent out a release titled "The Republican Congressional Index: A Dozen Years of Success." This document bragged about the steep education and health budget expansions during the 12-year Republican congressional majority. Another typical congressional GOP press release: largest federal funding increase in history for K-12 education takes effect, linked to reform. Senator Frist also bragged that GOP reforms had increased government dependency among senior citizens. During those 12 years of lost opportunities, the few elected Republicans challenging the party's intellectual bankruptcy, such as Tom Coburn, Republican Oklahoma, Jeff Flake, Republican Arizona, Mark Newman, Republican Wisconsin, and Ron Paul, Republican Texas, were ostracized, threatened, and even kicked off their congressional committees by the party's leadership. Now that Republicans have seen the consequences of their actions, many are changing their tune, apologizing for their decisions and making all sorts of promises about the future. Only time will tell if this was a Tiger Woods press conference type of staged apology or if it's real. But I do know this. No longer will any politician get the benefit of the doubt simply because he has an R after his name. America gets punked. A couple of years after Medicare passed in 1965, the calls for expansion started. In June 1967, Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare John Gardner announced a full-scale study into providing coverage for prescription drugs. 5 months later, the Senate Republicans killed the idea, saying that it was far too expensive. Boy, how times have changed. It took 36 years, but in 2003, the prescription drug expansion of Medicare finally became a reality. And this time, the charge was led by Republicans, a party that no longer seemed to care about price tags. The following year, Wall Street Journal economist Stephen Moore asked the director of the Congressional Budget Office, Douglas Holtz Eakin, what the total long-term unfunded liability was for the bill. Holtz Eakin answered with just three words, but they were three words that should instill fear into the hearts of anyone who truly cares about the future of this country. It is infinite. David Walker, who was then the Comptroller General of the United States, called the bill the most fiscally irresponsible piece of legislation since the 1960s. He explained, "We're not being realistic. We can't afford the promises we've already made, much less to be able to keep piling on top of them. We'd have to have $8 trillion today invested in Treasury rates to deliver on that promise." Asked by a reporter how much of that $8 trillion we actually have, Walker responded, "Zip." In summary, an infinite long-term commitment. No money to pay for it. Massive new entitlement programs that aren't fully funded is nothing new. Both FDR and LBJ had great success in saddling us with trillions they never paid for. But never before have Republicans, a party that supposedly stood for minimum government and maximum freedom, led the way. Why would they be behind such a massive expansion of government? The answer is surprisingly simple. They wanted to win an election. Bruce Bartlett, Forbes columnist and former Treasury official, explained. The Bush administration was already projecting the largest deficit in American history, $475 billion in fiscal year 2004. But a big election was coming up that Bush and his party were desperately fearful of losing. So they decided to win it by buying the votes of America's seniors by giving them an expensive new program to pay for their prescription drugs. Expensive is a big understatement. According to the 2009 U.S. financial statements, David Walker was only off by a little bit. Medicare Part D is currently underfunded by $7.2 trillion. One of the scariest parts of this whole debacle is how the bill was forced through Congress over the objections of conservatives, who actually wanted to be able to continue to look at themselves in the mirror. Bartlett explained, "When the legislation came up for an important vote on a motion to proceed, it was failing by 216 to 218 when the standard 15-minute time allowed for voting came to an end. What followed was one of the most extraordinary events in congressional history. The vote was kept open for almost 3 hours while the House Republican leadership brought massive pressure to bear on the handful of principled Republicans who had the nerve to put country ahead of party. The leadership even froze the C-SPAN cameras so that no one outside the House chamber could see what was going on." Republicans not wanting the public to see what they were doing is pretty funny, since what they were doing was selling out their long-cherished principles and values for short-term political gain. No one should have been surprised. The parties had been melding together for years. But to those who still thought that the words conservative and Republican were synonymous, it was a huge wake-up call. The Senate eventually passed the bill with 54 votes. Only 8 Republicans voted no, Lindsey Graham, one of the Republicans who allowed the bill to move forward by giving a key vote on an earlier motion that would have killed it, was one of them. Why vote yes to move forward and then vote no on the final bill once it already has enough votes to pass? I guess you'll have to ask the senator himself, but I do know this. After all of the debating, arm-twisting, procedural motions, and backroom dealing was done, and the monstrosity of a bill finally passed both houses of Congress, it went to the desk of a man who claimed to be a fiscally conservative, small-government Republican. He could have vetoed it. Instead, he signed it, saying, "Medicare is a great achievement of a compassionate government, and it is a basic trust we honor. Each generation benefits from Medicare. Each generation has a duty to strengthen Medicare, and this generation is fulfilling our duty." What he neglected to mention is that no generation has ever fulfilled its duty to pay for it. Republican regulation of freedom. Bush apologists will offer plenty of excuses for his spending, but there's another area in which he grew government that no real conservative can ever defend: regulations. If you use the Federal Register as an approximate measure for how intrusive the government is becoming in our everyday lives, then the Bush administration was a disaster. In 2008, the Register reached an all-time high of over 79,400 pages, up from 64,438 pages just 7 years earlier when Bush took over. Why care about regulations? Because they cause red tape, bureaucracy, and very often hidden expense. Every time a business has to comply with a new rule, it incurs a cost, one that usually gets passed along to consumers. And those costs are not insignificant. Economist Mark Crane estimates that compliance with regulations cost $1.172 trillion in 2008. To put that into perspective, total corporate tax revenue for that year was $304 billion. But the costs extend beyond compliance. The rules also have to be enforced. While Clinton had cut the government's regulatory staff by 969 employees, Bush added 91,196 people. Every one of those new employees gets a salary and benefits that add to our federal budget deficit. It's no surprise, then, that according to Veronique DeRougie of George Mason University's Mercatus Center, the Bush team has spent more taxpayer money on issuing and enforcing regulations than any previous administration in U.S. history. Give me government, or give me death. While plenty of crises are exploited by government, there's no doubt that the financial crisis, or at least the market's reaction to it, was very real. In September 2008, the Dow Jones Industrial Average crashed 1,200 points, and big banks like Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and Citibank teetered on the brink of bankruptcy. Spoiler alert, Lehman and Bear no longer exist. Who then swooped in to save the day? The same Bush administration economic dream team that never saw the crisis coming in the first place. It's like the plot of a bad horror movie, and the ending is just as predictable. We were told that we were facing the mother of all economic crises. We were told that, without action, the entire financial system could collapse. We were told that we'd seen nothing like this since the Great Depression. Then we were told something else. The government had a plan that could save us, and it was simple. We just had to use taxpayer dollars to bail out everyone who happened to have a lobbyist, a negative balance sheet, and a financial IQ of less than 80. We were living through the largest experiment in big government in 50 years, bigger than the Great Society, bigger than the Apollo moon mission, bigger than the Vietnam War. In the end, our politicians gambled $3.7 trillion, and counting, of our money in an effort to save us from the misery that their own ineptitude had caused. In the middle of it all, a supposedly conservative president sat down with the media and told the nation that he abandoned free market principles to save the free market system. It was not exactly George W. Bush's finest hour. The original bailout plan was drafted by Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson, the former head of Goldman Sachs. It had come together almost literally overnight and practically on the back of an envelope. The bank presidents were summoned to Washington, gathered into a boardroom, and commanded to sign on to the scheme. No was not an option. But where will you come up with these $700 billion, people wondered. Don't ask, he'd tell them. Just trust me. Let us spend the money, or the economy will cease to exist. It's the only way. The congressional leadership, the Bush White House, and officials at the Federal Reserve Bank scurried around in those weeks during the fall of 2008 like rats on a sinking ship. Now, many years and many trillions of dollars later, the ship is still taking on water. Some 5 million Americans have lost their jobs since the great bailout began, and another 8 million or so have dropped out of the workforce completely or can't find a full-time job. The real unemployment rate is close to 18%. The stock market and housing market are still in chaos. Incomes have continued to fall. It was, we can now safely say, one of the biggest frauds in American history. A supposedly capitalist country, organized as a republic, was actively strong-arming private companies into taking money, forcing others into mergers they didn't want, cutting deals with unions, penalizing private bondholders, and hiring a czar to monitor compensation. And the timing couldn't have been worse. Not only had a Republican president started America on a fast track towards socialism, but he was about to hand power over to a man who was salivating at the chance to use a crisis to fulfill his promise to transform America. For conservatives, a really bad situation was about to get a whole lot worse. Barack Obama, we're calling your bluff. Next year, when I start presenting some very difficult choices to the country, I hope some of these folks who are hollering about deficits and debt step up, because I'm calling their bluff. Barack Obama, June 2010. The Bush administration's use of crises to further its agenda did not go unnoticed by Barack Obama. After the election in November 2008, his incoming chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, told an audience of top CEOs, "You never want a serious crisis to go to waste." He further explained, "Things that we had postponed for too long, that were long-term, are now immediate and must be dealt with. This crisis provides the opportunity for us to do things that you could not do before." That was the understatement of the century. In retrospect, it should have been more obvious as to how this would play out. Barack Obama, a man who has made no excuses for the fact that he sees major social and economic injustices in America, was about to take over the country in the middle of a crisis. You don't need a Hollywood writer to guess what would happen next. Time put Obama on its cover with a cigar and a top hat, looking like a dapper Franklin Roosevelt. It was a fitting symbolism because Obama had a new deal of his own in mind. Right out of the gate, his first proposal was audacious and spectacularly irresponsible. A nearly $1 trillion spending plan, disguised as a stimulus package, with money going to a virtual all-you-can-eat buffet of liberal causes. It was 25 years' worth of stale Democratic spending proposals repackaged and marketed as stimulus. There would be money for the National Endowment for the Arts, Head Start, unemployment insurance, renewable energy subsidies, turtle crossings, a fund for federal bureaucrats to purchase a new fleet of cars, a bailout of the pork industry, how appropriate, new labor union jobs, and housing aid that would be ciphered through corrupt left-wing welfare lobby groups like Acorn. It was 8 years of progressive dreams passed in one fell swoop. The bill was signed into law within 40 days of the new presidency. It was an emergency, after all. Some federal agencies saw their budgets stretched by 80, 90, and 100%. It was as if Washington, D.C. had won the lottery, and in a way it had. A free-spending Marxist president with an inherited crisis is just as good as a Powerball ticket, if you live inside the Beltway. Government workers began singing Happy Days Are Here Again, just like Americans had in 1930 when they thought the worst was behind them. But all of that singing and optimism must have distracted them from reality. Americans were hurting, badly, and they were about to let their government know it. Keying on Keynes. Obama's gluttony of spending was inspired by someone who should be pretty familiar to you now, John Maynard Keynes. While we've been pretty hard on Keynes, the truth is that he'd probably be horrified to see how his ideas had been bastardized by the new generation of economists who see no end in sight to the virtues of government spending. In fact, Keynes himself once suggested 25% of GDP as the maximum tolerable proportion of taxation. That is far lower than where we are now once state and local taxes are factored in. Wasting money was virtuous. Thrift and efficiency and paying the bills on time was an evil, deadly poison. It was the 1930s and 40s all over again. Economic sanity was nowhere to be found, especially among the elected elite and the academics they hold up to parrot their beliefs. In January 2009, Obama, as president-elect, was publicly making the case for a far larger stimulus package than the $130 billion one he'd pitched during the campaign. To bolster his argument, two of his economic and finance advisors threw together a study analyzing what would happen to our economy with and without the stimulus. At the time, total non-farm payroll employment stood at 134.3 million. Here's what the advisors concluded would happen by the fourth quarter of 2010 under each scenario. Jobs, without stimulus, 133.9 million, down 0.4 million. With stimulus, 137.6 million, up 3.3 million. Unemployment rate, without stimulus, 8.8%. With stimulus, 7%. While we're not yet able to measure the results as of the fourth quarter of 2010, here are the preliminary figures. Jobs, 130.5 million, down 3.8 million. Unemployment rate, 9.5 to 10.1%. The total Obama jobs deficit, promised jobs minus actual jobs, is 7.1 million. I can hear it now. But imagine how bad it would have been if we didn't pass the stimulus. 4 days after the report was issued, Obama himself began using it as the basis of his predictions, telling an audience that his plan would create 3.7 million jobs, almost double his previous estimate. In typical Washington fashion, the prediction originally created by Obama administration economists was turned into fact and then deposited into the echo chamber of liberal politicians and advisors. Peter Orszag, former White House budget director. I want to again emphasize the reason that we think it's about the right size is it will help create 3 million to 4 million jobs. Jared Bernstein, chief economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden. It's not a promise, it's a pretty standard economic analysis. And actually, this part is not rocket science. I know there's a lot of economic forecasting that's awfully tough to understand. This isn't it. Senator Harry Reid, this bill creates 3.5 million jobs. Senator Chuck Schumer, and it's a very significant stimulus. 3.5 million to 4 million jobs is a lot of jobs. Larry Summers, director of the National Economic Council. Yeah, the plan will create 3 million to 4 million jobs more than the economy otherwise would have had, and that's before you get to the financial recovery approach. David Axelrod, senior advisor to the president. Well, look, I think in its broad context, the goal the president set was a plan that would create 3 million to 4 million jobs to help offset those dismal numbers that you just showed everyone. And I think that we're on track to do that. Not only is there no accountability for all the people who made these ridiculous predictions, but they are still out there making more of them, promoting new stimulus plans and predicting more job gains. Politics of the past. By the summer of 2010, the shine of Obamanomics had really started to fade. Everyone outside Washington felt it. The economy wasn't healing. Jobs were harder to find than ever. Half of the unemployed were out of work for more than 6 months. There were more than 1 million Americans who weren't even bothering to look for jobs. Incomes fell by 3.4% under the first year of the stimulus. Nearly 20 million American workers couldn't find a job or couldn't get a full-time job or stopped looking. Employers were virtually on strike. Yet the delusion rolled on. Vice President Biden, who had said, "In my wildest dreams, I never thought the stimulus package would work this well," put his dunce cap back on and went on a summer of recovery tour. Some recovery. The economy lost 221,000 jobs in June and another 131,000 in July. Obama went to Racine, Wisconsin, and told a gathering of underemployed workers that things would have been worse if the spending blitz hadn't happened. He said the stimulus kept the unemployment rate from rising to 15%. Pretty convenient, since just a year earlier, his own economist said the unemployment rate wouldn't go above 9%. It also directly contradicts the more recent studies by the president's own Council of Economic Advisers, which argues that the stimulus had perhaps a 1 percentage point impact on the unemployment rate. Republicans, starting to realize that the country was sick and tired of the nonstop spending barrage, or at least starting to understand that spending wouldn't help them in the upcoming midterms, finally began to balk. Obama responded as only someone who wants to get beyond the politics of the past could. He labeled Republicans as lovers of the wealthy and haters of the poor. During a weekly radio address, Obama said, "The Republican leadership in the United States Senate chooses to filibuster our recovery and obstruct our progress, and that has very real consequences. Think about what these stalling tactics mean for the millions of Americans who've lost their jobs since the recession began. Over the past several weeks, more than 2 million of them have seen their unemployment insurance expire. They say we shouldn't provide unemployment insurance because it costs money. So, after years of championing policies that turned a record surplus into a massive deficit, including a tax cut for the wealthiest Americans, they finally decided to make their stand on the backs of the unemployed. They've got no problem spending money on tax breaks for folks at the top who don't need them and didn't even ask for them, but they object to helping folks laid off in this recession who really do need help." Barack Obama may be a lot of things, but he's not a dummy. He knew that if he could change the argument from one over debts and deficits to one over morality, then he could win. Unfortunately, there is the small matter of those pesky little facts that keep getting in the way. First, on the idea that leadership chooses to filibuster our recovery, the president basically said that approving extensions to unemployment insurance is the key to the recovery. If that were true, then why didn't he just have far more money devoted to that in the original stimulus plan instead of all those shovel-ready projects? Second, he skillfully used the line, "They say we shouldn't provide unemployment insurance." That's completely false. In case no one has noticed, we already provide unemployment insurance, a lot of it. In California, for example, someone can normally obtain up to 26 weeks of help. But now, according to the Los Angeles Times, Congress has approved 4 extensions for a total of 53 additional weeks. States with very high jobless numbers, such as California, became eligible for 20 weeks on top of that, for a total of 99 weeks. This isn't a debate about providing insurance. 99 weeks is almost 2 years. It's about whether we should indefinitely provide insurance, especially when it can't be paid for. And lastly, the president, who was supposedly beyond partisanship, made the argument that we've all been waiting for. Republicans want the poor and unemployed to pay for tax cuts on the rich. Yep, those are definitely the kinds of accusations that are going to bring this country together. Who wouldn't want to make tough sacrifices after a pep talk like that? Bush didn't spend enough? Ronald Reagan incurred $2 trillion of debt in the 1980s, but that debt accomplished 2 missions of great long-term consequence. First, it financed the Cold War military buildup that helped free the world from communism. And second, it financed tax rate reductions, which helped rebuild the U.S. economy after the dreadful stagflation of the 1970s. Under Reagan, the national wealth increased by at least $9 trillion. And that's the big economic difference between Reagan and Obama. With Obama, there are no pro-growth or pro-business tax cuts in his agenda. The mentality is to target the wealthiest citizens, because there aren't enough of them to matter at the polls, and redirect the money through welfare and entitlement programs. The Obama administration and congressional Democrats defend their record deficits and debt by arguing that during the Bush years, critical government investments were neglected. Deficits, we are told, were a result of the Bush tax cuts and the war on terror, while Republicans devised an ugly plot to starve the beast of government. I hate to ask a dumb question, but which programs were starved exactly? Most budget items grew by 4 or 5 or 6 times the rate of inflation, 21%. Bush's so-called neglect, federal spending increases from 2001 to 2009, inflation adjusted to 2009 dollars. National defense, 81%. Income security programs, 51%. Medicaid and SCHIP, 63%. Veterans benefits, 72%. Health research and regulation, 68%. Highways and mass transit, 39%. International affairs, 69%. Community and regional development, 90%. Creative solutions, spend and tax. So what is the Obama strategy to balance the budget, which is consuming 25% of national output, up from 20% a decade ago? Answer, new taxes. But even liberal think tanks agree that taxing will not be enough to cover the nearly $1.5 trillion budget deficit this year. According to the Tax Policy Center, a left-leaning think tank, Washington would have to raise taxes by almost 40% to reduce, not eliminate, just reduce, the deficit to 3% of our GDP, the 2015 goal the Obama administration set in its 2011 budget. Okay, fine, but there's one major problem with that. Obama has promised to only raise taxes on couples making more than $250,000 a year and on individuals making more than $200,000. According to the Tax Policy Center, the top two income tax rates would have to more than double, with the top rate hitting almost 77% to get the deficit down to 3% of GDP, if Obama held to that promise. The numbers just don't add up. The Wall Street Journal has determined that taxing the top 2% of wealthiest Americans at a rate of 100%, that is, taking everything they've got and assuming they still go on working and investing for basically a zero after-tax income, would run the federal government for less than 6 months. It doesn't take an economist to realize that if you won't cut spending and you can't get enough from just taxing the rich, then the only thing left is expanding tax increases to the middle class. How will they do that? Simple. It's already being whispered about in the hallowed halls of Congress. A value-added tax, or VAT for short. The VAT is a version of a national sales tax that gets added at each stage of a product's production and is ultimately paid by the final consumer. The Tax Foundation says that a U.S. VAT to get rid of the deficit would have to reach at least 18%. Think that sounds like a crazy rate? Think again. The United Kingdom's VAT will be rising from 17.5% to 20% next year. In announcing the increase, their finance minister said, "This single tax measure will, by the end of this parliament, generate over £13 billion a year of extra revenues. That is, £13 billion we don't have to find from extra spending cuts or income tax rises. No cuts, no income tax hikes, just pay more money on everything you buy. What a deal." Deal or not, you can't argue with the allure of a VAT for short-sighted, self-serving politicians. They can pass it and seriously argue that they never voted for a tax increase and that they fought hard to maintain government services. What they won't tell you is that, like most new taxes, the VAT won't lower the deficit or help eat away at the national debt. Instead, the money will be spent on a host of brand new services. Randy Holcomb, an economics professor at Florida State University, recently studied the effects of the VAT in other countries. He found that the rates almost always rise after the tax is initially introduced, no surprise, but that government spending also increases and economic growth decreases. Don't fall for the scam. The VAT will be spun as a way to pay for the mistakes of the past, but all it will really do is add another one to the list. Hope. A president's first long-term budget is a blueprint, a reflection of his agenda, his aspirations, and his hope to leave the country in a much better place than he found it. But that's not what Barack Obama's first budget was. To anyone with a fiscally conservative bone in their body, the document read as if it were written by Hugo Chavez or François Mitterrand. It was a socialist fantasy, a literal handbook on how to bankrupt a country in 10 easy steps. This first budget, released in early 2009, called for $42 trillion of government spending over the next decade. Even the president's historic tax increases would not keep up with this soaring spending. The national debt would rise by $9 trillion. In Washington, the saying was that a trillion is the new billion. Bumper stickers began to appear that read, "Please don't tell Obama what comes after a trillion." ADD moment. Can you guess what this sea of red ink budget was titled? A New Era of Responsibility. At least President Obama has a sense of humor. Obama was proposing that the government borrow more money in the next 10 years than it had in the first 225, and he made no apologies for it. Answering questions aboard Air Force One in March 2009, Obama said, "So if you look at our budget, what you have is a very disciplined, fiscally responsible budget, along with an effort to deal with some very serious problems that have been put off for a very long time." It's deceitful to call a budget that commits America to 10 more years of massive deficits very disciplined and fiscally responsible. I wonder what exactly irresponsible spending would look like. Wait, I take that back. No, I don't. The president's next budget, released in 2010, was even more reckless. Over the following decade, it proposes to spend $45 trillion. Push the debt held by the public to 90% of GDP, more than twice its current level. Raise taxes by $3 trillion. Raise taxes on small business owners and upper-income taxpayers by an average of $300,000 over the next 10 years. Borrow 42 cents on every dollar spent. Add an additional $74,000 of debt per household. And these figures were likely optimistic. They assume an economic boom is just around the corner, which would create trillions of dollars more in wealth and thus much more tax revenues than mainstream forecasts predict. His budget endorsed Congress's $800 billion cap and trade bill, but leaves the cost out of its tables. It claimed $132 billion in vague program integrity savings. It bragged about $7 billion in program terminations and cuts the previous year, and proposed $23 billion more for the current year, without mentioning that every saved dollar went into new government spending. Not a nickel went toward deficit reduction. Finally, his budget assumed large yet totally unspecified discretionary spending cuts happening at some point in the future, never the present. President Obama was highly critical of the $3.7 trillion in deficits that President Bush ran up over his 8 years in office, and he was right to be. Yet Obama's budget proposal calls for borrowing $7.6 trillion should he remain in office for the same amount of time that Bush did. If that comes to pass, Obama would have added more to the national debt than every president before him combined. If this is Obama's blueprint, then we better all start wondering what the building is going to look like once construction is finished. Americans don't want to be deceived, but we do want hope. We want to know that if we do our part, work hard, play by the rules, live within our means, then things will turn out all right in the end. But Obama's budget shows that that's not the case. If we do everything right and if all of his projections are perfectly accurate, something that we all know is a long shot, then we'll be worse off in 10 years than we are today. We'll have continuing deficits, more debt, and a much bigger hole to dig out of. Is that any way to live? Is that any way to run a country? Hope can come only from knowing that you are on the right track, knowing that you are fighting valiantly, and that despite long odds, it's a fight that can be won. Hope can come only from knowing that everyone is fighting toward the same end goal. Knowing that you've got the best technology, the best experts, and the best team on your side. Hope can come only from knowing what you are really up against so that you can devise a plan to beat it. In other words, hope can come only from knowing the truth, and that's exactly what I'm about to give you.
Part 2. The Crime of the Century. The federal government is currently saddled with commitments for the next 3 decades that it will be unable to meet in real terms. Former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, June 2010. Chapter 10. The Truth. By now you've seen the pattern of lies, broken promises, and outright corruption that has been epidemic in America for decades. It's obvious that the battle over small versus large government was waged a long time ago, and the small government side lost. What we're now debating is something far more serious: the survival of the last free country on Earth. With those kinds of stakes, the last thing we can do is let our politicians continue to deceive us. America has a life-threatening disease. We don't need to be coddled. We need to be leveled with. Consider this chapter the first step towards doing just that.
Where we are now. There's a lot of talk in the media about the financial legacy we're leaving behind for our children and grandchildren. That's fine, and it's obviously important, but we need to realize that the threat is far more imminent than that. This isn't a battle for the next generation. It's a battle for this generation. Unfortunately, if history is any guide, it's a battle we're going to lose unless there is a radical and likely very painful change in course. The truth is that for 72 out of the last 100 years, our government has spent more money than it has taken in. If you shorten the time period, the statistics get even worse. Over the last 50 years, we've run deficits 44 times, 88%. And over the most recent 10 years, we've run deficits in 9 of them. That's astonishing when you really think about it. Financial restraint and accountability has been, by far, the exception instead of the rule for a very long time. While fingers can be pointed at any number of people or parties, there's really only one group that bears ultimate responsibility: us. The American people have been, for the most part, willing to sit idly by as our leaders spent away our future. Sure, we didn't sign the checks or make the backroom deals, but we didn't hold people accountable either. Decade after decade, we express outrage and shock over our financial condition, yet we continue to elect the same people again and again and expect different results. It truly is, as Einstein once said, the very definition of insanity. Mandatory bankruptcy. Bear with me for 30 seconds of boring budget appetizers before we get to the main course. There are 2 terms that are immensely important to understand: mandatory spending, sometimes also called direct spending, and discretionary spending. Despite their names, these terms don't refer to the relative merits of the spending, i.e., there is some discretionary spending that is extremely important, and some mandatory spending that's not. They refer to legislative processes. When Congress creates a mandatory spending program, i.e. the Social Security Act of 1935, it determines 2 things. First, who will be eligible to participate in the program, and second, what the benefit formula, which is used to figure out how much each participant receives, will be. From there, the program runs permanently on autopilot. Annual spending is not determined by Congress or the White House, but instead by demographics. Costs are a function of how many people are eligible, how many actually sign up, and where they fall in the benefit formula. So, for example, if the poverty rate increases, more people enroll in food stamps. The cost of the program automatically increases, and the increased funding becomes a mandatory government obligation. In practical terms, mandatory spending is essentially hands-off. It continues to grow according to existing law and can't be touched without a specific act of Congress to change the eligibility rules or benefit formulas, and good luck with that. By contrast, discretionary programs are budgeted annually by Congress and the President. If they want to spend $500 billion on defense this year, they must pass an appropriations bill and get it signed by the President that provides the Defense Department with that amount. This, of course, ensures that the system of checks and balances envisioned by our founders is adhered to every year. Congress passes a bill, the president signs or vetoes it. But autopilot spending gets around this essential part of our Constitution by forcing future administrations and generations to accept decisions made well before their time by politicians who may now be either retired or dead. It truly is a modern-day version of taxation without representation. As any budget expert will tell you, no honest discussion about getting the country back on a sustainable track can happen without talking about mandatory spending, of which entitlement programs are the most common form. Why? Because, as you'll see, these types of programs make up a large and growing part of our annual spending. Unfortunately, they're also generally considered to be the third rail of politics because they are so well defended by their supporters. As a result, most politicians, other than second-term presidents with nothing to lose, pretend they don't exist and instead focus on small, symbolic cuts that will have almost zero effect on our long-term problem. In 2010, autopilot programs, including the programs that we'll call the Big Three, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, will eat up 56% of our federal budget, and that does not include the interest that we pay on the money we have to borrow to meet those commitments. For context, total spending on national defense and education makes up a total of 22% of the budget. 2010 Selected Entitlement Spending. Social Security, $721.5 billion. Medicare, $457.2 billion. Medicaid SCHIP, $284.5 billion. Deciding how to spend our money as a country is very much like deciding how to spend our money as a family. Some things are necessities, food, shelter, clothing, and some are extravagances, flat-screen TV, tennis bracelet, smoothie maker, which we could easily cut back on in tough times. But America's priorities seem to have reversed themselves sometime in the late 20th century. Instead of focusing on necessities like national defense, we let our extravagances like entitlement programs take priority. In the backward way that Washington doles out our money, they first give large agribusinesses their full farm subsidy entitlements and the wealthiest seniors their full Medicare drug entitlements, and then use whatever scraps are left for discretionary items like body armor for our troops. This isn't just irrational, it's immoral, a sad reflection of how far America's values have come from the days of our founding. Predictably, the surging cost of these autopilot mandatory programs has been squeezing out the discretionary programs. Since the early 1960s, Washington has consistently spent about 20% of GDP a year. Yet the composition of this spending has changed dramatically. In 1962, two-thirds of all federal spending went toward discretionary programs, and only one-third went toward mandatory programs. Back then, the largest discretionary program was national defense, and it accounted for half of all federal spending. But over time, the entitlement seeds we've planted have flourished. Social Security costs grew faster than the economy. Medicare and Medicaid benefits were created and expanded. And President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society further enlarged the welfare state. As a result, the ratios began to change. Mandatory spending, plus net interest on the debt, now comprises two-thirds of the budget, while discretionary spending has been squeezed into the remaining one-third, with defense comprising just one-fifth of all spending. The national security state has officially been replaced by the welfare state. Unfortunately, it's only going to get worse. Over the next few decades, as 77 million baby boomers, 10,000 per day, begin retiring into Social Security, Medicare, and often Medicaid, these programs' costs are projected to double to 20% of GDP. And that doesn't even take into account the new Obamacare costs. By putting two-thirds of all government spending on autopilot, where it can grow with no oversight, no constraints, and no limit, Congress has essentially lost control of its own budget. No other government in the world writes a blank check for its pension and health care programs, and for good reason. It's an obvious road to ruin. Teachable moment. The other way to look at this is to consider that all of the revenues we expect for 2010, $2.165 trillion, will only cover three budget categories: defense, $855 billion, Social Security, $715 billion, and Medicare, $451 billion. Everything else we spend on, from the education of our kids to the eradication of our diseases, will require deficit spending. Everything. Pork, not just the other white meat. Despite all the promises made to the contrary, earmarks continue to add to our debt. According to research conducted by Citizens Against Government Waste and Taxpayers for Common Sense, spending bills included nearly 10,000 pork projects, costing taxpayers $16 billion in 2010. That's obviously outrageous and should stop immediately, but here's the problem. Earmarks and pork distract us from the larger financial issues we face because they are perfectly prepackaged for media consumption. The dumb museums and idiotic research projects make perfect 60-second news segments. But when you compare $16 billion in earmarked spending to the projected 2010 deficit of nearly $1.6 trillion,